From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on March 29, 1960, in the pages of the New York Times. The Times carried a full-page advertisement titled, "Heed Their Rising Voices." The advertisement solicited funds to defend Martin Luther King Jr. against an Alabama perjury indictment. That advertisement describes some of the police actions against civil rights protesters, and in some cases, the descriptions were inaccurate. For example, the advertisement said that Alabama State Police had arrested King 7 times. The actual number was 4. The Montgomery Public Safety Commissioner, L.B. Sullivan, filed a libel lawsuit against the New York Times, and he won. An Alabama court awarded him a judgment of $500,000. But the Supreme Court ruled 9-0 in favor of the Times, establishing the now famous actual malice standard. The court's ruling held that news publications could not be sued for libel by public figures unless the plaintiffs were able to establish actual malice in the false reporting of a news story. 52 years after that ruling, Republican presidential contender Donald Trump says he would try to, quote, open up libel laws if he's elected. He says the news media is too often inaccurate, and he doesn't like the standard for actual malice. What would the impact be on American journalists if Trump has his way? This hour, it's part history lesson, part exploration of the value of a free American press. And my guests include Dick Moss, news director for the Democrat and Chronicle. Dick, nice to see you in studio.
Good to see you.
Jeremy Moll is here. Jeremy's a reporter for City Newspaper. Jeremy, welcome back to the studio.
Thanks for having me.
And Chris Thomas is a partner with Nixon Peabody. And Chris is someone who, if I needed representation for libel, I don't know. Chris, first was the first person I would ask, who do I call? And it might be you.
I have some standards, though.
You do have some standards. That's good to have standard. Actual malice, is that one of your standards?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, what I want to do first is I want to listen to some of the comments that Donald Trump has made recently that kind of sparked this discussion. And then we're going to go back, and there are parts of the historical record that I had forgotten that Chris has been pointing out over the last couple of days that I think are fascinating. Some of them are a bit terrifying, but let's go ahead and first let's listen to what Donald Trump said. This was speaking to a rally in Texas, and here's what he said about the New York Times, Washington Post, and journalists in general about his disappointment in the American media.
If I become president, oh, do they have problems. They're going to have such problems. And one of the things I'm going to do, and this is only going to make it tougher for me, and I've never said this before, but one of the things I'm going to do if I win, and I hope I do, and we're certainly leading, is I'm going to open up our libel laws so when they write purposely negative and horrible and false articles, we can sue them and win lots of money. We're going to open up those libel laws. So that when the New York Times writes a hit piece, which is a total disgrace, or when the Washington Post, which is there for other reasons, writes a hit piece, we can sue them and win money instead of having no chance of winning because they're totally protected. You see, with me, they're not protected because I'm not like other people, but I'm not taking money. I'm not taking their money. So we're going to open up those libel laws, folks, and we're going to have people sue you like you never got sued before.
All right. Now, he followed up in a conversation with the Washington Post editorial board, expanding on those comments. He said he wants a system in which a journalist must be compelled to either publish a correction or stand trial. Here's what he said, quote, "I think that they can do a retraction if they're wrong. They should at least try to get it right. And if they don't do a retraction, they should, you know, have a form of a trial. I don't want to impede free press, by the way. That's the last thing I would want to do is that." Then he was pressed by the Washington Post editorial board on actual malice and getting rid of actual malice. And here is what Donald Trump said about that. Quote, "I've had stories that are written that are absolutely incorrect. I'll tell you now, and the word intent, as you know, is an important word in libel. I would make it so that when someone writes incorrectly, yeah, I think I would get a little bit away from malice without having to get too totally away. I think many of the stories about me are written badly." End quote. So, Dick Moss, news director of the Democrat and Chronicle, what's your take when you hear the comments from that rally and then his follow-up comments to the Washington Post?
A couple of things come to mind. The first is that I'm not sure that he entirely understands libel law and its application by the courts. I also am not entirely sure he's he's putting together, he's mixing up facts and sort of perception. He's absolutely right that if we get something factually wrong, we should correct it, and most respectable publications do do that. What he seems to be talking about is stories that he doesn't like or gives an impression of him that he doesn't care for, which is not necessarily incorrect. It's just somebody else's take on what he is doing. And that's separate from libel and something that's factually incorrect.
So it does sound like he's got a confusion on the law to begin with.
It seems that way to me.
Sure. Jeremy Moll, what do you think?
I just kind of wonder if he's confusing factual errors with stories he doesn't agree with. People saying things about him that he doesn't like but that aren't wrong. That's what I pick up from a lot of the comments. And that's what I pick up from a lot of the comments he's made in Raleigh's sentence.
Okay. And I'm curious, before I talk to the attorney in the room, if Dick and Jeremy, for example, think this is a lot of bluster, but it's unlikely to go anywhere, because even if he's elected president, he can't get in the first day and say, well, we're tearing up the way libel law works in this country. I mean, there is process for that. So in many ways, Dick, do you think this is bluster that goes nowhere, even if he's elected?
If he wants to change the law, it's going to take a long time. He'd have to stack the court with judges who agree with his position. He could go through a legislative approach, but even that would take a long time, presumably. It depends on whether he could get the votes in Congress. So it's not something that he can change on his own as president. If he becomes president,
he may try,
but legally, there are only so many ways that he can change the precedent.
Sure, Jeremy, would you be concerned that he would try, or do you think it goes nowhere?
I think it would be a bad idea to dismiss it as an empty threat. The fact that he has come as far as he did when nobody expected that of him in the first place, and the fact that he is making this threat, I think is cause enough for worry.
Okay. And, you know, you mentioned you were at the Trump rally this weekend in Rochester.
I was.
And there's this interesting, for me, kind of this dissonance in that Trump has benefited by more free media than any presidential candidate in history. There's
yes,
no question.
He has.
No question about that.
And his image in general has been built through media exposure.
Through media exposure, no question. So, and he also has a kind of a cozy relationship with a number of journalists, certainly not all, but some.
Well, he likes the tabloids, correct?
Well, yeah, and people like Joe Scarborough, and, you know, there's a number of friends that he has. But at the same time, you said, being a part of that group of journalists, there was a moment in that rally where, you know, they're kind of turning at you, and he's kind of heckling journalists, and the crowd starts to do the same, yes?
Yeah, I mean, it was more than once, and it was more than just him. There was another speaker who had preceded him that, you know, was shouting the evils of the media. And, you know, to have a room full of people just turn around and boo you very loudly, and you can tell they're not looking at you too favorably. That's a little intimidating to be in a room like that.
And so it sort of jives with the notion that you at least have to take it somewhat seriously if he's talking about making it easier to sue journalists, this antagonistic relationship.
Yeah.
And do you take it seriously when he told the Washington Post editorial board, quote, I don't want to impede free press, by the way. The last thing I would want to do is that.
I question whether he truly means that.
Dick, what do you think?
If he is able to do what he says he wants to do, it would, I think, cause a lot of journalists to second guess themselves as they're doing their reporting and perhaps not report some of the things that they report now.
Sure, I think
apparently that's what he wants.
Yeah, yeah. So Chris Thomas, when we look at history, the reason that there is an actual malice standard, I mean, for those of us who took journalism law and going back to those ivory tower classes, we studied Times v. Sullivan. But I think it's good to kind of set a historical record and work through this. And you have been sharing a number of materials, not the least of which is a 1957 set of comments by the judge in the initial case that before it got to the Supreme Court. So where's the history lesson start for you with this?
Well, it actually starts in about the 13th century.
I'm
not going to bore you all to death with that. But it starts with the English common law. In order to prevent dueling, where people would kill one another, there was implemented a civil basis for dealing with defamation, where nobody would end up dead. And so that is about when defamation suits began. People could address one another in a civil context that didn't involve guns. And what ended up happening was the standard that was developed back through the English common law is that the speaker, the person who said the allegedly defamatory thing, had to prove truth. The burden was on the speaker. It wasn't on the person who was saying that it was defamatory. That's completely different than what we have today. And it's completely different than what we have today because of New York Times versus Sullivan. But prior to New York Times versus Sullivan in 1964, that was what we had. We did have a situation across the country, and these are all creatures of state law, not federal law, that the plaintiff did not have to prove that the statement was false. The defendant had to prove it was true. And so when we look at the law that was in place in 1960, which is when in Alabama, which is when this New York Times advertisement was posted, it was completely stacked against the New York Times because the New York Times, or the plaintiff in this case, Mr. Sullivan, merely had to allege that the statements that were made in the New York Times article were about him and put him in a negative light. And then it was up to the jury to decide what the dollar value was. Okay, so that's sort of the historical context. Speaking about this particular lawsuit, it was in front of a fellow named Walter B. Jones. And Judge Jones was born in 1888. His father was the governor of Alabama. His father was the soldier who carried the Confederate surrender flag from Lee to Grant at Appomattox. He was a deeply avowed racist, and I have in my hands here, I didn't post this to Twitter, but was the article that you were talking about a minute ago, that Judge Jones wrote and published in 1957. And I'll just read a paragraph from
Absolutely.
It because it demonstrates what the common thought was by a highly regarded jurist in Alabama and probably many other places at that time. And I'll ask the listeners to think about this quote I'm about to read and ask yourself whether the New York Times even had a prayer here. So here it goes. The title of it is called "I Speak for the White Race" by Judge Walter B. Jones, Montgomery, Alabama. It goes on to say, "I speak for the white race, my race, because today it is unjustly assailed all over the world. It is being subjected to assaults here by radical newspapers and magazines, communists, and the federal judiciary. Columnists and photographers have been sent to the South to take back to the people of the North untrue and slanted lies about the South. Truly, a massive campaign of super brainwashing propaganda is now being directed against the white race, particularly by those who envy its glory and greatness." It goes on to say, "Pseudoscientists tell us there's no such thing as a superior race." And the coup de grace is, "Their real and final goal is intermarriage and mongrelization of the American people." We read that today, and this is, 60-some-odd years ago, and it's breathtaking. This would put you onto the list of
59 years ago, yeah.
59 years ago, that would put you onto the list of the Southern Poverty Law Center's white supremacist watch group for today. But he was a noted, elected, well-regarded jurist of the time, before whom the New York Times stood not a chance because, one, he was clearly biased against them, but more importantly, the law was against the New York Times because Mr. Sullivan merely had to say that those little misstatements that you talked about at the beginning, Evan, namely, and I'll just tick a couple of them off, So in this broadside, and if you want to see it, you can go to my Twitter.
And I've retweeted, and Megan Mack, our producers, have retweeted as well. So you want to see the what was published in the New York Times in 1960 that set all of this off, it's there now.
It's right there, yeah. And so one of the things that L.B. Sullivan claimed was false was that the students sang "My Country, 'Tis of Thee." Well, they didn't. They sang the national anthem.
Okay.
Right. Another thing that he said was wrong was that police did not actually ring the Alabama State College campus. They just had a police presence there. And that the entire student body did not protest. It was really just a very large number of them.
Well, we
laugh about that today because it sounds so ridiculous.
You're going to get sued over that. It's like going to a Bruce Springsteen show and saying he opened with Thunder Road. Turned out it was Badlands, and now the boss is going to sue you for
right.
that?
Right. Yeah, right. And we look at that now as being utterly absurd, but it the trial judge said, yeah, this thing's going to trial. And there was that $500,000 verdict against the New York Times. As importantly, Evan, there were four black ministers who were named. And these are now household names: Ralph Abernathy, Fred Shuttlesworth, Reverend Shea, and Reverend Lowry. You know, they had judgments put on them. And what the segregationists did in this very case was to attach all their cars, attach their property, and sell them. So this is not just some theoretical ivory tower discussion. This had real effects on real people's lives. And what happened after that, between the period of time that verdict was issued and the time that the Supreme Court of the United States decided the Sullivan case 4 years later, $300 million of judgments were entered against newspapers and the heads of various civil rights organizations. Why? To debilitate them. It was used as an absolute strategy for smashing the opposition. Why am I talking about that? Well, in the clip that you played a second ago, Evan, what does Trump say? We can sue them and win lots of money. He's going back to the segregationist playbook from the early 1960s.
Bullying.
And you know, if you read a book by Floyd Abrams on this case, he was, of course, the noted lawyer, probably the greatest First Amendment lawyer ever, who was involved in this case. And he said that he understood that the New York Times was actually teetering on the precipice of going out of business because of this $500,000 fine or a penalty. This has real serious effects for real people on the street, namely the reverends who lost their cars and their property, and news organizations. And the idea that we would go back to that, or that there would even be the risk of going back to that, from my perspective, is disturbing and, frankly, deeply un-American at this point.
So even though, as Dick said, and we'll talk about this in a minute, Chris, we will get into what it would actually take to change that.
Yep.
Even though it's very unlikely, even with a Trump presidency, it sounds like just the rhetoric alone is something that we should be taking seriously.
Yeah, and when Jeremy just said a minute ago, he had a crowd of people, probably 5,000-6,000 people, Jeremy, turn around and look at you and basically,
sure,
you know, giving you the thumbs down. It tells us that this is not just one person, Trump, up there, you know, saying this. This is something that at a certain level can gain some traction. And for that reason, it absolutely needs to be addressed. It needs to be discussed. It needs to be aired.
If you think that what Chris is saying about using libel law as a form of bullying and to push people around the way it happened decades ago, if you think him saying that Trump is kind of using that kind of tactic, consider this. Donald Trump has already said, and let me pull up the actual quote, he has already admitted he sues journalists right now to bully them. He said in an interview that he knew he couldn't win a libel suit against a writer who in a book said that Trump wasn't a billionaire, he was just a multi-multi-millionaire, and that his actual estimated net worth was probably more like $250 million. Trump didn't like that because if Trump, even though he doesn't want to put his tax returns out there, he likes to play up the notion that he's a multi-billionaire. So he sued that journalist for libel, and he lost. But here's what he said afterwards. He said, quote, I spent a couple of bucks on legal fees, and they spent a whole lot more. I did it to make his life miserable, which I'm happy about, end quote. So, Jeremy, as a journalist now, even if with the libel law the way it is now, what does it say to you to have someone who has become a political leader saying, I will now at least use a threat of a suit. I will try to sue, even with the current standards, which are very high, just to make your life harder because you're going to have to hire an attorney, you're going to have legal fees, and that's going to hurt you more than it hurts me. What does that say to you?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't afford an attorney. I mean, just to put that right out there. If you – I believe in one of the links that you had sent to me before this show, you it touched on the English or the UK version of libel law where – it's the person making the statements who has to prove that they're right or honest or whatever. And people take advantage of that there and they sue. And that, as Chris was saying, can have very real, like a very real impact on papers and news organizations. At minimum, it will make reporters think about what information they put out. And you may not get the same sort of reporting that you do from people now. And at worst, it's going to put newspapers out of business.
Chris, you want to weigh in on that?
Because
I've been trying to dig up a little as much as I can on UK libel law, which is quite different. But go ahead.
Well, let me first talk because Jeremy, you put your finger on the thing that concerns me the most. Dick Moss is sitting here. He's part of the Gannett organization. Gannett is a behemoth, and they have some of the best First Amendment attorneys working in house for them. They fight the fight right out on the front lines along with companies like Hearst and the New York Times and even locally outfits like Hubbard, and they are hardcore First Amendment warriors from the New York Times versus Sullivan mold. So I don't have a whole lot of concerns about Gannett being able to defend itself. It will, and it will do so as it's always done very aggressively. It's papers like yours, Jeremy, that are small. Mm-hmm. They probably run on a fairly close to shoestring, week to week basis. And a lawsuit against a paper like yours is going to put you out of business. And what's that going to do? It's going to reduce the amount of speech that we have in this community. And from my perspective, that's only a bad thing. And that is what I think Mr. Trump is talking about here. Now, Jeremy, I think it's important to note as well that this is not just a left-wing, all left-wingers think that New York Times is a great thing and all right-wingers think that New York Times versus Sullivan is a bad thing. Just the opposite. There are scathing critiques of Mr. Trump's statements in both The Federalist and also in The National Review.
Sure.
Hardly known.
Daily Caller, well, absolutely.
Right.
Sure, yeah. And imagine if, a Democrat could go after Breitbart in the same way that Trump would want to go after The New York Times.
That's a great point. I think about, the local impact that this kind of thing can have. Because I think sometimes it helps for us to think about what would happen locally. Well, I can tell you, if Trump were successful, it gets elected and was successful in reversing New York Times versus Sullivan, and I agree with Dick that it would be an uphill battle and it would take a long time. Evan, you'd likely be out of work pretty soon. Bob Lonsbury would be out of work pretty soon. Rachel Barnhart, Gary Craig, Sean Carroll, people who go out and dig are going to be out of work because of these lawsuits. And this is not conjecture. That was what was happening in 1960 and in 1964 in order to quash speech. Now, let me talk a quick second about what we started out here with, and that's the UK. I could imagine somebody like a Mr. Trump saying, oh, come on. I mean, the UK, they love tea. They eat crumpets, and they've got a different view of it, and we really ought to be with them because they're much better mannered. Well, as Jeremy was just saying a second ago, their system stinks, and there was a reason that our Supreme Court voted 9-0 to reject their approach. And the reason is that it serves to quash the vigor of speech. And Jeremy was talking a second ago, alluding to libel tourism. Libel tourism is where Americans or people from other countries, usually people from billionaires and oligarchs from Russia, people from China, and real criminals and brigands they'll go to Europe, they'll go to UK to sue out libel matters. great example that I think probably all of the listeners are going to know about is that first-class lowlife Lance Armstrong. Remember? For years and years and years, I'm not a doper. I've won all these clean. I'm the greatest guy in the world. And so where did he go when he wanted to shut down a journalist who had done a dig on his doping? He went to the UK. And guess what? He won. And guess what? About 2 years later, he's on in front of Oprah saying, oh, I really, you know, it was really a lie. That's because the UK system does not provide protections for journalists to dig into the dirt. And it's a perfect example, I think, of why it is that this idea, whether it comes out of Trump's mouth or someone else's mouth, is bad news for America.
And I want to remind people that we fought a war against the UK, the British, to free ourselves and get away from those kinds of demands. One of the first libel cases in the colonies, even before America became America, was a lawsuit against John Peter Zinger, who was a publisher in New York City, put out broadsides very critical of the colonial governor. And the colonial governor used the existing sedition libel laws of the time to take him to court. And a jury of his peers, colonists, found him not guilty of libel and started the road that led eventually to Sullivan. So that colonial governor was using libel as a bully would, which is what Trump is talking about. And we fought a war against that kind of thing. And the freedom of the press goes all the way back to the beginnings of this country.
I find it interesting. There are a number of British journalists who have taken note of Donald Trump's comments in recent weeks and have written about it. Here's British journalist Peter Jukes writing in the Daily Beast recently, quote, "Welcome to my world, Donald, where the biggest threat to free speech is not press regulation or laws against incitement or harassment, but our chilling and atavistic laws of defamation. Unlike U.S. libel laws, which since the 1964 Supreme Court decision, New York Times v. Sullivan, require proof of actual malice, in the U.K. the burden is on the defendant to prove that a reputation has not been damaged. Say I claim that I believe Donald Trump is a reactionary populist who barely comprehends the sentences independently issued from his mouth. I'd still be liable to be sued here unless I could prove that opinion was an honest one. Combine these oppressive libel laws with an instinctively secretive government, it's frankly staggering that British journalists continue to expose any scandals at all, and it is no accident that The Guardian broke most of its Snowden revelations about NSA mass surveillance in the United States." End quote. That's British journalist Peter Jukes writing in the Daily Beast. But let's do this. Let's get a very short break, and we're going to come back. And I'm going to try to play devil's advocate. I've got an email from a listener saying, essentially, but what to Donald Trump's point that, well, what if the American public who was staring at Jeremy Moll at that Trump rally and making him feel uncomfortable, maybe it's a sign that they are upset with the American news media, and maybe it should be at least a little easier to sue when they get it wrong, and aren't they getting it wrong too often? Well, I'll try to play devil's advocate and entertain that position as well. As we talk about libel law and the future of a free press in this country with Dick Moss, news director of the Democrat and Chronicle, Jeremy Moll, reporter for City Newspaper, Chris Thomas, partner with Nixon Peabody, and your comments, if you want to call the program, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. More connections next. Coming up in our second hour, New York State votes in the presidential primary this coming Tuesday. We look at the Republican race. And yes, Donald Trump has a huge lead in the polls. But the way the delegate system works, each congressional district is like its own mini election. We'll break down how it works and how voters here could have a big impact into whether Donald Trump is the eventual nominee. That's our discussion next hour.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Ralph Honda, serving Rochester since 1933, offering new and pre-owned vehicles, including the 2016 Accord Family Sedan. Ralph Honda, Honda done right. RalphHonda.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Here is an email from a listener named Richard who says, Evan, media bias is so obvious, so pervasive, so overwhelming, that they not only do a disservice to the populace, but they trash the Constitution. This was not what the Founding Fathers had in mind when they wrote that First Amendment. The internet did not kill the newspapers. It was suicide. That's Richard. Before I get to the next one, Dick Moss, you want to weigh in on that?
Sure. Oliver Wendell Holmes used a great phrase, the free marketplace of ideas. Journalists are ought to be responsible for what they write and correct it when they get it wrong, and they should hold themselves to a higher standard, as we all should. But the free marketplace of ideas is what will make our what makes our country great, and anything that tappens down on that is a problem, I think.
And Richard, frankly, is just wrong about the framers.
Yeah.
That during that early period, the level of discourse in the press was in the gutter compared to where it is now.
It was just
there was far more scurrilous rags that were out there. That was just par for the course. And, you know, our framers knew that, and that's why Jefferson said he would, you know, far rather live in a world that did not have government than he would want to live in a world that did not have a free press. So, Richard, go back to your books, take a look at the history. You'll see that that's exactly what our founders wanted, and that is exactly why they put that into the First Amendment and not some other amendment.
And in terms of the bias, a lot of the earlier papers in this country were run by, at least in some way, shape, or form, political parties.
They were. Well, and here's the other thing. I mean, people sometimes are like, oh, you know, we shouldn't even talk about, you know, shouldn't be talking about, you know, someone's personal life. Well, guess what? You know, the Thomas Jefferson Sally Hemings affair and relationship was talked about in 1804. So it's not like we're carving, you know, tilling new ground here. I think what's going on is that there's sort of an effort to roll us back to some place that we weren't before.
Let me read another email from a listener, and this comes from Scott. He says, really just a comment, in the same manner that Trump plays on the aggravation and frustration that people have with the establishment, with the established way that legislation is occurring, he plays on similar frustration that people have with media, enabling the reaction that the reporters got at his rally. There are some who report, who do it in an extremely biased manner, that I wouldn't even say are journalists as much as infotainers looking for ratings and money, that fuel negative feelings toward legitimate journalists. That last comment, I think Jeremy might agree with and appreciate. I mean, there are plenty of people out there, I think to Scott's point, that you would say biased or have a point of view and opinion, et cetera, which... You know, I mean, again, we can have a whole separate discussion on whether objective journalism is even real or at least having a self-awareness of bias.
Sure.
But what Scott is saying, Jeremy, is that some of that out there injures the reputation of hardworking, real journalists. Do you agree with that?
Sure. I mean, one bad apple ruins the bunch or whatever the cliche is.
Sure. Yeah. And Dick, what do you think?
I absolutely agree with Jeremy. Yeah.
All right, let me grab Kara on the phone, who's been waiting way in. Kara is in Webster. Go ahead, Kara.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just was thinking, and we talk about this a lot, but Trump is always so threatening, you know, and he's so threatening to the media constantly that it begs the question, what would happen if the media just stopped covering him to the extent that they cover him? I mean, at the beginning of the show, one of your panelists said that, you know, Trump has been exclusively built up by the media, by media coverage. And, you know, the best medicine, in my opinion, would be if he got a lot less coverage. We're sitting on the radio today spending an hour, and Donald Trump's name is mentioned every 45 seconds.
It's going to be, and so, Kara, let me jump in and say, and stay in the line, because I think you're raising an important point here. And so let me say a couple of things on that. First of all, it's going to be both hours because our second hour, we're talking about the state of the Republican race in general. But I was talking to Adam Chodak on WROC-TV on Monday, and he asked me, what do I think of some of the comments from Republican and Democratic voters that the media failed in covering Trump in many ways and overcovered it? And I said, most of the complaints are absolutely valid and that there has been a journalistic embarrassment. Most of last year, if you look from June to the end of the year, you know, CNN and Fox News basically gave him wall-to-wall coverage at every campaign event. And all he did during those campaign events was riff and insult and talk about himself and talk about polls. He wasn't really breaking anything new. And Marco Rubio was right to point out that the only time they ever did that for Marco Rubio was when he was insulting Trump, not when he was talking policy, not when he was talking about his proposals. So, yes, I think there has been a journalistic embarrassment throughout this campaign. Right now, Donald Trump is the likely nominee. He is leading in the delegates, in fact, to the point where he is either going to be the clinched nominee or he will have more delegates than anybody else when it gets to Cleveland. And so the coverage is something approaching something that is more appropriate right now. I'm not saying it's perfect. But what I'm saying is the reason we're talking libel law this hour is Donald Trump is the likely nominee, and he's got a very good chance of being our next president, and he is talking about taking us back to a standard that was eliminated 52 years ago by the Supreme Court for a very, very good reason. So so I think there's two things in play here. I agree with a lot of your sentiment, but what I'm trying to do is take a look at specific proposals and ideas and let people know before they vote next Tuesday what's at stake here. What's possibly at stake? What would it, you know, what would the impact be? So I guess.
Right. No, and I appreciate that. Absolutely. I mean, I'm not suggesting that you shouldn't be having the conversation. I think it's an important conversation to have. But it's just, you know, it's unfortunate that somebody in power can threaten an entire group of people. And what the response is that they cover it and cover it and cover it instead of just walking out and saying, OK, well, nobody's going to be here to cover your rally. So the extent of your rally is going to be the 5,000-6,000 people that are here.
No, Kara, thank you for the phone call. And I take the point, and I'll let the other panelists weigh in on that as well. But there has been an addiction to Trump. I mean, he certainly impacts ratings. CNN's last debate that had, I think, at least five candidates, the first person interviewed off the stage by Chris Cuomo was Donald Trump. And then, after half an hour of coverage, they had Donald Trump on the set with them for a second interview after the debate. I mean, they just couldn't stop. It's like a child who found a box of cookies and their parents weren't even looking. So I agree in a lot of ways of what you're saying, but that's why we're trying to take a look at actual policy proposals, et cetera. And so I think I agree in many ways, and I share some of your frustration. Dick, what do you think?
If you want charges of bias, if we didn't cover him at all, we'd certainly get that.
Sure.
Not covering him is not a choice.
But it was overcovered and the wall-to-wall stuff that wasn't even coverage. It was
particularly last year.
I'm just going to put Donald Trump on for 45 minutes with an open mic, and nobody else gets that. That's different than journalistic coverage, right?
Right.
Okay. And Jeremy, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the coverage of Trump has been nuts. He's received just a ton of attention. Would I have handled it that way if I were in the national media's shoes? Probably not, but I'm not. So now we just kind of have what we have.
Yeah, okay.
What I think Kara's question raises is the notion that there should be some self-censorship. And that makes me nervous. And you know, I'm looking over at you, Dick, where you know we heard Kara ask the question, well, shouldn't we just not be in the room and shouldn't journalists just ignore him? That concept, this concept of self-censorship is sort of the flip side of that coin, and we've always been reluctant to go down that path as well.
Right, exactly.
All right, let me get back on the to the phones. Robert in Fairport next up. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, I think that the press has put itself in kind of a compromised position in this election cycle. I think that the evidence of that was that Boston Globe front page piece that ran, I don't know, like a week ago, where it you know, straight out of The Onion, where it was like a fake, you know, what would the first few days of an administration look like if Trump was running the country. I just think that's unprecedented that a major press outlet would do something like that. And I've never in my life ever seen anybody do anything like that for another political candidate.
Robert, thanks for the phone call. He's referring to the Boston Globe. I don't think it was on their front page, but they did
It
wasn't, right, Dick?
It was on their ideas section front, which was kind of their opinion, Sunday opinion section.
So it was kind of an idea of it was a faux front page from what the Boston Globe might be covering if Trump is president. And by the way, one of the headlines was on libel law, if I remember correctly, him going after journalists.
Right. Yeah.
So even the Boston Globe is saying if he's president, get ready for an aggressive attack on the American free press. Did you have any problem with what the Globe did there?
I, whatever problems I had with it were not the fact that they did it, but I don't think these days that kind of satire really flies very well in a time when people mistake Tina Fey's skits for Sarah Palin and it actually gets on air that way. There's so much commingling of satire, and people misunderstand and post onion stories as real stories. And so I think that kind of satire is a little misplaced these days. So I think they made a mistake that way, but I, and it's not something that I would suggest doing, but I think they have every right to do it, particularly in an opinion section.
And by the way, it's important to point, I mean, Robert, he is right, they did it. He was wrong that they put it on the front page.
Right.
Had they put it on the front page, would that totally change it in your mind?
I do think it would have been it would have caused more of a problem for them in terms of their respectability as journalists, putting it on the front page.
Okay. Jeremy, what do you think?
I thought the product itself was actually brilliant. Satire has a way to sort of bring ideas to the front that traditional reporting and opinion doesn't. And so when I see things like that, I think they're interesting, and I think they sort of do have, they can play a good role in people's conversation.
They further the debate. They point out issues in a way, like the court jester used to point out issues to the king. It was the only person who could say some things that would really get under the king's skin but wouldn't get his head cut off.
And I think I may be wrong on this, but satire is actually protected.
Oh, absolutely.
Speech as well,
right? Oh, absolutely.
Well, on that note, I think, let me just read two more comments from listeners, and I think I want to build on what Jeremy just said there. First of all, Robert writes to us and says, "It is scary that the idea of silencing a journalist because someone does not like the piece they wrote has to even be discussed. Last week we were discussing a right to Yelp law. I may not like Yelp, but someone should not be silenced because they're not writing a positive review. Where would that stop? My Facebook is deleted because a movie director doesn't like my review of their movie. My peer-reviewed essay is deemed poor, so I silence my peers in order to get my master's degree. A politician doesn't like that their bill was voted down, so they pass it anyway. It seems like a very slippery slope to destroying integrity and the right to free speech." That comes from Robert, but an email from Mark says, "I'm not even a Trump supporter, but I understand his complaint. The media gets too much wrong, and at some point, they have to be able to be sued if they are continually inaccurate." Chris, what do you make of Mark's point there? And I think let's hit that, and then let's hit the question on how we even would start to distinguish between opinion pieces, satire, journalism.
It's a gross generalization, first of all. And when you have gross generalizations, it turns into arguments and positions that are off base. So our Supreme Court dealt with this in New York Times versus Sullivan, a 9-0 decision. It's not very common these days to have a 9-0. It was 9-0. And what Justice Brennan wrote, writing for that 9-0 majority, is, I'll just read it right out of here. Mm-hmm. "The erroneous statement is inevitable in free debate, and that it must be protected if the freedoms of expression are to have the breathing space that they need." Some of the greatest jurists of all time were sitting on that bench, and they recognized that in the hurly-burly of modern public life, just as it was back in the 1800s, people are going to say things that aren't accurate. But we need that to happen because, and I'll read the another quote from New York Times, "Because we consider this case against the background of a profound national commitment to the principle that debate on public issues should be uninhibited, robust, and wide open, and that it may well include vehement, caustic, and sometimes unpleasantly sharp attacks on government and public officials." I hear what the texter or emailer just wrote, but first of all, I think it's a gross generalization, and our Supreme Court said long ago, guess what? We as Americans value, and our founders valued, that free, open, robust discussion that brings about the best ideas and, you know, that marketplace that Dick was talking about.
All right, Jane in Rochester, next up. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, this thing about Chris Cuomo, I didn't see all of that, but if he gave Donald Trump such excess attention and time, it seems to me what we are doing is we are labeling people as journalists who do not deserve that term, the press. And it comes in, we can get just the people who entertain us and they're trying to make a buck for the network, all the way to the just sheer Joseph Goebbels propagandists. But I think if you call someone a journalist, we have to hold them to a much, much higher standard and call them out on that. Why did Trump get so much attention? That's all I want to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. That's a question for Chris Cuomo and CNN, and they probably, they have defended themselves. I mean, you've seen Anderson Cooper say to Ted Cruz, hey, we called you and you don't show up as often as he does. Every time we ask him, he comes on. I think that's a little flimsy, but that's not, that's sort of tangential to the discussion on libel, and maybe it's part of the discussion for the next hour. Next hour, we are talking about the state of the Republican race. I will say to any listener, if you are at Trump or Kasich rallies in Rochester these past few days, we want to hear from you next hour. I want to get a few more comments in from listeners before we close this hour as we talk about libel law. Jake writes to the program and says, Evan, I thought Trump was full of pure hot air until this issue came up, and this actually worries me. Could he have any chance of doing what he is suggesting? I can't imagine there being support for this. Well, Jake, we've been talking about the fact that he probably doesn't. I mean, apart from an attempted unilateral executive action on libel, if he's president, and who knows if that would carry any weight.
No, wouldn't it be deemed unconstitutional?
Sure.
Unless he was able to, as Dick was saying earlier, stack the court.
You got to stack the court. So you got to get enough jurists. And right now, it would not even be stacking a court to balance toward a conservative viewpoint. I suspect John Roberts would not want to be voting to open up libel law the same way Trump said. I suspect. I don't know. I've never asked him. But Chris, wouldn't you be surprised if Clarence Thomas and John Roberts and Sam Alito would be in favor of going back to where we were with libel?
Well, I don't know about Clarence Thomas.
Okay, yeah.
You know, I look at, you know, the burn that he took during his confirmation hearings, mm-hmm. and it would not at all surprise me if he thought that he was mishandled during that and may have a view of New York Times versus Sullivan that's a little bit different. What we do know is that Scalia was no great fan of New York Times versus Sullivan.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, he actually said on the Charlie Rose show back in 2012 that, you know, he just thought it went too far. But in terms, and I really just don't know where Alito would be on it. But I think Roberts would be opposed. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Breyer, Kennedy, and
yeah.
Kagan would not be for it. But here's the point that I think the writer is getting at. What we know is that we had something different before 1964. Okay. And we had a Supreme Court that said, guess what? What was going on in 1960 and 1964 is not how the founders wanted to run our country. And they flipped. Is it possible? Is it conceivable that could happen again as more and more people look at the Jeremys of the world with, you know, ardent hatred, saying you're the evil media, and so we want to reverse New York Times versus Sullivan? Yeah, I think that could happen, but it's become such an ingrained concept in who we are and how we cover ourselves. And when I say ourselves, I'm talking about our government, our politicians, our public figures. And that is the environment in which we've been for the past, you know, many decades. And I think it really boils down to another line from the Sullivan case where they wrote, judges are to be treated as men of fortitude, able to thrive in a hardy climate. Surely the same must be true of other governmental officials. Criticism of their official conduct does not lose its constitutional protection merely because it is effective criticism. And I think that describes the environment that we're in now. And I think that the Supreme Court, as well as pretty much all of the district courts of appeal, are going to keep that for a very long time.
All right, Dick Moss, about Dick and Jeremy, about 30 seconds each. Just your final thoughts as we go forward here about the value of a free press in the context of this discussion.
I go back to Oliver Wendell Holmes and the free marketplace of ideas. You might not like what we report. You might not like the way we report it. But that's what makes our country strong, is the fact that we're able to report it at all. That's what we're here for.
Okay. Jeremy Mull.
I'm not sure I can really say it any better than Dick just did.
But I'll boil it down. More speech, in my opinion, is always better than less.
That's well Absolutely. Said. That is a Michael Pollan-esque distillation of the entire hour. And I will just put my final note on this and say that regardless of the size of the papers represented here or the financial heft and the power of attorneys, et cetera, I think that there has been a cynicism about American news media. Some of it I understand, but I see a lot of great journalism locally and nationally, a lot of journalism that that I'm proud is happening in our own newsroom and in some of our colleagues. And I hope it continues, no matter who is in the White House, et cetera. So our thanks to the panel. Jeremy Moll, reporter for City Newspaper. Nice to see you, Jeremy. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me again.
Dick Moss, news director for the Democrat and Chronicle. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Chris Thomas, partner with Nixon Peabody. And Chris, thanks for the history lesson and all of the context. Great having you.
Thanks.
Short break. And again, if you were at one of the Kasich or Trump rallies, we are talking. Yesterday we talked about the Democratic, the state of the race before the primary on Tuesday, having a discussion of the GOP. State of the race, and we'd love to hear from you next hour.